Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. I love the Zen path. I really do. I love the frame it puts around life. I love the practice. It's my life's work to do the practice as well as I can and to help other people get the most they can out of this, what I consider to be a wonderful practice. Not just for people, but also for the world. So there. And I hope some of you find your lives bettered by this practice, even transformed in some small way, and that it becomes a kind of lifetime container that helps you navigate this this life. I hope that. And I think it's healthy to develop a kind of critical eye toward this path over time that we are doing, that we're on. And I think it's possible, if we don't, to misunderstand some things about the path that we've chosen. Because I think that every path, every way, every religion is full of mistakes in its past and full of problems in its current manifestation. Zen is no exception. I think there is some danger in getting so wrapped up in that critique all the time that we don't just throw ourselves into practice. We have to learn to do that too, I think. We have to sort of hold both of those in some way, maybe at different times. But I will say that my practice has been colored by and strengthened by, I think, looking and experiencing the warts and the underbelly of this practice. So my hope is to give this talk every year, my plan. Got that idea from Igyoku, who runs the Zen Center of Los Angeles, friend and fellow teacher of mine. She calls it the polishing the bones once a year. And I hope I get better and better at it. Right now I'm reading a book that has been on my reading list for a little while. It's called Imperial Way Zen by Chris Ives. There's another book which more people know about called Zen at War by Brian Victoria. Anybody read that, by the way? Right here? No? Okay. All right. We've got to get into critical Zen studies at some point. But it's this Imperial Way Zen. Chris Ives was a translator for my teacher. I sort of know of him. I don't think I ever met him. But boy, it's good. So interesting, so well written, well researched. I've got all kinds of footnotes highlighted, things to look at later. And it's about the Zen establishment's relationship with the Japanese state from 1868. Well, who was it? Admiral Perry came and opened up Japan, and through 1945. And the rise of what they called Imperial Way Zen, which is a variety of Imperial Way Buddhism, in which the state really co-opted the not Shintoism and also Buddhism, in service to sort of make it useful. That's what I think. That's the first chapter of this book. Actually, is useful Buddhism. And the book is really, this book is Imperial Way Zen, is a review of the work. This is what really makes it interesting and alive for me, of a Rinzai priest and a professor at what was later called Hanazono University, which is a Rinzai, the Rinzai school university in Japan, Ichikawa Hakugen, and he was really the chief critic of Zen from within Zen in the run-up to the war. And so this is really a kind of critique from the inside, and I find it so interesting and worthwhile. Many Zen and Buddhist leaders fell into line with the war effort in Japan, and a good number of them championed it. And they also used the language of Zen to justify serving and fighting in the war. And Ichikawa wonders, what would it have taken to have made the Zen school? He was in the Myoshinji line, as I am too. What would it have taken to make that more resistant to and less compliant? Maybe more attention to the precepts? Maybe more compassion training? Maybe less tight relations with power. Chris Ives chapters 2, 3, and 4 each take an aspect of Zen that he thinks kind of weakened it in the face of and made it ripe for unethical behavior. I'll read you the titles. Say a little bit about them each. First one is peace of mind at any price. And this was a critique of the kind of acceptance of circumstances no matter what. And this is a live critique, I think, of Zen Buddhism right now, at any time. You know, peace of mind being the overriding and ultimate goal, to find peace and in some way ignore conflict, ignore war. This is a possibility in Buddhism, I believe, not just Zen Buddhism, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. Peace of mind, I believe, is good, but we have to learn to mix it up with no peace of mind. We have to let no peace of mind breathe and realize it as a part of ourselves and a part of our path. We have to dare to do that, to mix it up and to take an initiative not only with peace, with that kind of death of ourselves, but also with life and with opinions and views, to be able to lose those and to be able to hold them as well. The next one, he says, is the next title is Indebted to Our Proper Places. And in this one, he really talks about, I should say, I have not finished this book. I've read about half of it and skimmed the other half. But so this chapter I didn't read in detail, but it's really about the idea of karma and how that's been used over generations to keep people kind of in their place in society. That if you're born into a certain class, for instance, that's just your karma. if somebody's born into an upper class, of course, you know, that's just what the past lives have led to, and that's therefore their proper place. I think, in a way, Confucian values, he doesn't say this, but it's just my opinion that Confucian values, maybe he does say it, I didn't read the whole chapter, lead to help with this. And I've seen a fair amount of that over my career as a Zen person. When we studied, we did our Dharma study last fall, we talked about Confucian and Taoism and coming into Zen in the way it mixed with Zen. And I think coming to the West now, this is among the many changes that is happening. It's coming from a more Confucian model to a more democratic model. The Protectors of the Realm is the last chapter in this series. And there were many, we studied this last fall too, there were many rituals in Zen and Buddhism that developed to help people through difficult times, but also rituals that developed to help the state. And in exchange, you know, so Buddhism protects the realm, and in exchange gets protection from the state. And that symbiosis has sort of gotten Buddhism through a lot of tough times. There have been times when it's been suppressed by the state, but many times where it's been close to the state. And we did a good bit of study of that. For instance, in northern China, it was much closer to the state. It got to be quite in with the state, and they got big monasteries and slave labor from the prisons, and there was a whole bunch of stuff, including corruption, that went along with that. In southern China, it sort of stayed by itself more. The Sangha had its own rules, not so close to the state as it was, as my understanding was, in India. So this whole relationship with the state is something that is very interesting to me, and also these days too. Like how are we going to? I don't know. It's probably too long a tangent, but I did have a conversation with a Christian minister, a conservative Christian minister, not too long ago, who was just crying over. Told me the whole lineage of how Christian conservatism got so close to the state, and how it started in the 1970s with this person, and it got closer and closer, and now it's like a deal with the devil for him. And so it is, these are not just ancient problems. So I think in general that Buddhism has tended to go along with the status quo, either relatively separate from society like it was in India, or close to the state and reliant on it for patronage. I didn't live in Japan in the run-up to World War II, but I did live with my teacher, Joshu Sasaki, who had ethical problems, challenges. So that was alive for me and is alive now in me. He had a problem that he never corrected. And really, even though there were promises and this's and that's, never really addressed, in my opinion. He used his position as a teacher to have sexual relations with many of his students, and he found ways to do this outside of the practice and also within the context of the practice. And he uses a position of authority and the structure of the Sangha, the structure of the group, to obscure his problem and kind of make sure that he didn't really have to deeply address it. Um, unfortunately, in there have been a number of Zen teachers who and Americans too, who have had some variety of this problem. I've heard that I heard this relatively recently, that the Japanese way is very clear. Like, you don't challenge the teacher, you just leave if you don't like the teacher. That's just the way it works. There were a few of us who didn't want to leave and wanted to change things. And, you know, it was a good scene. I felt that. And it was a very valuable practice. I think that to this day. And Joshi Roshi was a very good teacher in many, many ways. I feel that too. I worked for change very imperfectly. My dear friend Giko, who just came to give a talk recently, wanted me to be much more combative than I was. Still, I did more than most and instituted some reforms that I thought did some good. And the problems that I worked with were somewhat related to the problems that I listed before, that Ichikawa, I think that was his name, listed. Peace at any cost. There was sometimes a sense among some that it was practice at any cost, that no matter who got hurt, no matter what, that the most important thing was finding peace of mind, or finding Kensho, or getting Satori. More important than anything was kind of the wonderfulness of the teacher and the preciousness of the practice. The proper places, keeping our proper places. The practice I grew up had a lot of Confucian elements, to be sure. One of which was that the teacher's word was fairly well absolute. The West, just the way it was set up. And the protector of the realm, I don't know if that fits as well, but at the same time, many people I felt, and to this day sometimes when they talk about their teachers, there is a kind of magical feeling I have, like that teacher is magical in some way, has a kind of magical power. And even though Joshi Roshi, I felt, was very down to earth and didn't exactly, most of the time didn't encourage that, it was still very present. I felt it very present often. The experience that I've had that has affected my teaching. So, I tend to underemphasize the be-all and end-all of enlightenment. I have seen somebody who was a very good, a remarkable practitioner and awakened, I assume he has the documents, and had big problems. It does not solve all of your problems. This I believe and teach. I feel the way we structure ourselves in our sangha is very important. You know, sometimes that feels like to a fault, but we work on governance at this place, and we're going to keep working at it, learning from others, learning from the Christian tradition, learning from anywhere we can get good ideas. To make sure that teachers at the center have checks on their power, to make sure, also it's very important to me, that the bonds of Sangha are strong, that we don't just get a situation where the student and teacher have a strong bond and that you don't have this kind of bond. We need to see that this place has a modern Western level of transparency. We've worked, I think, effectively on that. It's important to me that women have a strong representation in the Sangha and that women teachers are part of this center, and that we continue to have women involved in at all levels of the Zen Center. And I think that ethical training and grounding need to be part of the teaching here, and not poo-pooed, as sometimes they are in Zen, in the Zen tradition. I also think that the Zen Center needs to be part of our community, our wider community, and have plenty of contacts with other organizations. That I need to have contacts with people like Peggy and Larry and other Buddhist teachers, and that the Zen Center itself has connections in the community with all kinds of different groups. And I also emphasize the role of self in our practice, not just no self. That is something that I learned, maybe ironically, from my teacher. A couple of these things my teacher was very good about. This, for instance, about the importance of not just no self, but also self, that they have to learn to, that we have to learn to, for those two things to coexist in a healthy way. Ichikawa singles out the role and language of negation of self as making Zen quite useful during the war. And today, you know, I believe that when I hear somebody talk about Zen as all about self-negation, it's a big red flag for me. I just know there's going to be trouble. You know, if it's all about how self is an illusion. Maybe I have too much of a hair trigger about that, but I really feel it's a misunderstanding. I feel that we have to learn to have both a strong no self and a strong sense of self too. That we need personal responsibility to be part of this path. Coincidentally, both Ichikawa, I haven't seen anybody else talk about it this way except for me, and then I got it from Joseph Campbell. Ichikawa talks about the vertical and the horizontal as a metaphor, the vertical being the spiritual axis and the horizontal being the societal axis. And the need to travel in both ways, both vertically in the to do our no self practice, and also to travel horizontally, to go out into the world, to not ignore society and the problems in society, to get out there and help and be helped. So I believe strongly in both of those axes, that we have to both lose ourselves fully, and to do that, we have to lose society, we have to lose our family, we have to lose good and bad altogether, and be unafraid to do that. But at the same time, we have to pick it up again and go out and know good from bad and work in society. So finally, I think there are some historical tendencies that we should be aware of. And most of these apply to Buddhism more broadly, and it's not an exhaustive list. It's just what I came up with this morning. I think there is a tendency, has been a tendency, to glorify no self at the expense of self at times in our tradition. That needs to be watched for, I think. Now, I should also say, the reverse of these is a problem in each one, so it's complicated. To be far more concerned with enlightenment than acting ethically, and to imply that awakening is enough to have you act with decency and compassion. To emphasize wisdom over at the great expense of compassion. To go along to get along. To be male dominated with few openings for women. I didn't even put here something about the kind of supreme reverence for a teacher. That can be a problem too. I think all these things are changing in the West. It's really a fertile time right now for Buddhism. And for practice in this country. I mean, you know, it's alive here. It's not dying. It's really living. And according to me, you know, we're making new problems. Where, you know, sometimes there's a kind of confusion between what's mindfulness and what's Buddhism. Sometimes maybe it's possible to emphasize the horizontal at the expense of the vertical. And sometimes there's an assumption that we know what Buddhism needs and we're going to change it. And that without much reflection, you know, molding it to my needs is just what it needs. So I think we have to develop a deep respect and understanding of the tradition and its forms, and also to be able to learn from the mistakes that this tradition has made and help shift it and change it. And I know I'm part of a changing tradition, and I hope my experience with the many strengths of traditional practice and the pitfalls too will help change it for the better and give you a good experience of Zen. This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.